Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the Tire!
Good evening, everybody. This is Dave Briglio, and this is Making the Play. Tonight is our seventh episode, and our guest will be on Shirley's Dr. Lena Estenall, and she's going to be talking about how those of you who do coach and teach can achieve better high performance yourself, the challenge that you face. And I think it's a nice lead-in from previous shows where we've been talking a little more directly on how to deal with young adults and kids, but again, the purpose of this show is to really help out those of you that are out there helping others find better ways to do it. And so bring her on board here. Elena, are you with us?
Yes. Thank you so much, Dave. I'm really honored to be here with you.
Excellent. And Elena also has her own show on Coach on Fire Radio. She's a best-selling author and background in performance psychology. She was also a performer. And with that said, Elena, I'd like if maybe you could just kind of lead in with, you know, your story a bit, because I know that you really appreciate the power of the story and how it helps to communicate and motivate people.
Sure. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and share with your tribe. It's funny because I think that we all have a really powerful story and that we all have something that's really important to share with the world. And it's part of the reason why I'm so much into story, because I think that it's not just mine. It's that we all have powerful stories. And when we can honor our own stories, then we're able to honor other people's stories. So, you know, that's kind of the grounding from which I come. But I was basically a ballerina and, you know, as a kid, and was always sort of really obsessed with trying to figure out how to improve my performance, because I was a very, very introverted, shy kid. And the thought of being on stage and being on the limelight was just terrifying. So I had some of the worst performance anxiety that you could imagine. I was a really, really good practice dancer and not a very good performance dancer. And I was often frustrated with my own performance when I was dancing, because I knew what I was capable of doing when I was in the studio and really like doing my thing and enjoying it. But when the pressure came on, then I often crumbled and I wasn't able to do as well as I wanted to. And so I kind of got a little obsessed with like trying to figure out like what is it that I need to do like to get myself to be better. And little did I know that one of the things that I had been obsessed with prior to this, it seems like it's a dark thing, but when I was 12, my mom gave me the book Anne Frank's Diary, and she thought that it might be really good for a 12-year-old to just get to read some of the stuff that another 12-year-old was writing about.
Right.
And the thing, you know, just like, here's, you know, the stuff that happens in your body and blah, blah. But the thing that really got to me was the fact that they were being persecuted and that they were trapped and that eventually she died in a concentration camp. And so I got really obsessed with reading Holocaust survivor stories. And part of that was because I was trying to understand what allowed them to live. What made those people live where most other people died. And I started trying to figure out, like, if I can figure out what made those people live and I can figure it out and then I can teach it to others, then we can all be resilient and we can all be survivors. And little did I know that these two areas of inquiry actually were leading to the same thing. You know, both the resilience and peak performance actually led to this area of study that, you know, we call it now positive psychology and performance psychology or performance enhancement. And so when I was about what I want to say, about 5 or 4 months before graduation, I was about to graduate with my dance degree. I had a job in hand. I did something that was really against my intuition, which was lift another dancer because I was being asked by a choreographer to do that. And I broke my back.
Oh, my.
And that ended my career.
Yeah. Wow. And you were how old again at that point?
I was 20. I was actually 23. So I was kind of an older university dancer, but I was 23. And at that time, I pretty much felt like, you know, all of my life went down the drain, you know, like I spent all of my life training and missing vacations and missing hanging out with my friends and doing all kinds of things so that I could become a better dancer and I could have a, you know, a performing career. And that happened. And that pretty much took me into a tailspin, as you might imagine.
Right.
And in some ways, you know, I now believe that everything that happens for a reason. And it was exactly what needed to happen for me in my life. Because though at that moment, it did get me very close to killing myself. In that moment, I kind of heard this voice of like, well, it's your choice. You know, it's your life. It's your choice. And I think that was a super important lesson for me to realize that I had a lot of agency in terms of what I made of my life, and that I could allow something like this to really be the end of me, or I could allow something like this to ignite something different in me. And so at that moment, I sort of vowed to myself that I was going to get better and that I was going to heal myself and then try to heal others and kind of give myself into helping others.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously, to say the least, a very defining moment for you. And you mentioned that it started, you know, that the inquiry you had 10 years earlier, you know, as a, I guess you want to call it, very young adult, older child, into what makes people move on. But what other things, aside from having parents that encourage you to, you know, experience that through, what else might you attribute to that being able to, I guess, hear that voice, you know, that said, hey, it's your choice? Because a lot of people won't hear that voice, or they'll hear something else, mm-hmm. like you're out of choices. There other people in your life that put you in a position maybe to hear that?
That is such a really good and powerful question. And I hope it doesn't deviate us too much, but I think it's something that I really speak about a lot. And I was always a very, very intuitive child and a very spiritual kid, though I was actually raised in a family that was atheist. So it's kind of fascinating because in some ways, on one hand, I am actually kind of like a third or fourth descendant, fourth generation from like shamans. But my mom never really embraced that part of, you know, she kind of sometimes would take me and I would like kind of see some of the ceremonies, but I didn't really know where to put them. And then the other hand, my dad was super atheist and very much against religion. So in some ways, my spiritual path was very much like almost like a rebellious thing, which is kind of funny because, you know, for most people it's the other way. You know, but I had some experiences early on that really connected me to knowing that there was something much bigger than just this world. So it's interesting because what happened is that at that moment, I heard this voice before I lifted this girl's like, don't do that. And I went against it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it was like, okay, like I heard that voice and I instead was trying to do the people pleasing thing that, you know, I had been doing for years and I wanted to, you know, get the attention of the choreographer and whatever. And so I was just doing whatever he was asking me to do. And that ended my career. And so when I was kind of in that rock bottom moment, when I heard it's your choice and, you know, you are powerful, it was kind of like this recognition of like, there's that voice again. And if I don't hear, if I didn't hear it last time and then the outcome was bad, maybe I need to start listening, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think we all believe in it, but maybe not. You know, it's that thing that, right, it's called intuition. You know, we'll talk about that voice inside, but it makes a lot more sense when you're not actually trying to listen to that voice, you know, the whole idea.
Absolutely.
Everyone, I think, can agree with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's right. But it's in that time, whether it's to do something or not, that, you know, is it a fear and I have to step over it, or is that really the right thing? And I guess with that, you know, how did that take you forward into being able to do what you do for others now? I assume that was your major pivot point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have to say that I had had other really powerful experiences where I had listened and, you know, like I was lost and then others. I went to Cuba to dance when I was like 14 or something, and I got lost in that city and I was terrified. And I just prayed and I asked for guidance. And I and, you know, we talk about intuition being a GPS, and it literally was like I stopped at each corner and I was like, which way? And I just waited to hear an answer. And I like did exactly like was like right, left, straight, whatever. And I got to my destination simply by listening to my intuition. So it wasn't something that I was like totally, you know, I had the experience, the positive experience, but at that point I had been so disconnected from it, you know, that hearing that was an important reconnection for me. And it's definitely, you know, even now my business is called Intuitive Business Mastery, because I feel like intuition is something that I teach people to pay attention to really ignite it, to foster it, to listen, because it's been such a defining and guiding force in my life. And it's like, it's literally saved my life. It's saved some of my clients' lives. And a lot of times it's funny because when I've worked with coaches and I've worked with athletes, there's this idea of, I call it sort of this little hierarchy, right? We always want to be confident. And so we talk about confidence, and then we go from confidence to trust, and we go from trust to faith, and then faith and intuition kind of ride that same vibration and that same wave of being able to be in a state of openness and a state of focused awareness that you're able to hear and listen and know what it is that you need to do and be able to do it in the moment that you need to do it.
Well, I think it's interesting the way you laid that out, that it's trust, then it's faith, and then you move into intuition. And it reminds me of, in high school, I had a teacher, the class was called Religious Quest. And it was, yes and no, I mean, on the religious side, it was talk about literature, but in one of, it was powerful literature. It really had to do with what it really meant to have faith. And I will always remember this because it was something I'd never heard before, which was to have faith. It was always, you know, in the more mainstream, it was, well, that means you have no doubts. And what he brought up said, no, to have faith, you actually have to acknowledge all the doubt. There is no faith without doubt. Before that, there's trust, where you say, okay, fine, I'll just forget all of the things I'm fearing. I'm just going to trust you blindly. And then the next step is to actually say, yes, I know you can do me wrong, but I'm actually moving past that. And I guess by never linked it to intuition.
Yeah. Well, and in some ways I think about that speaks also to fear, right? Like often people come to me and they're like, I just want to be fearless. I want to be able to be, you know, fearless. And I'm like, well, the concept of fearlessness is nice, and it's totally bogus. You know, there's no real fearlessness. There is courage. And courage does not mean that there's absence of fear, right? It's like, as you feel the fear and you acknowledge it, and then you do it anyway. And so it's, I think that they ride in that this similar place, because in some ways it's like, it's just acknowledging that there's a lot of unknowns And that you need to be able to trust that higher knowing and take action when you need to.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, again, whether it's as we move in our careers or we're trying to tell the next generation how to deal with their own things, it's, well, you got to, you know, stop being afraid. And I remember hearing that, and that is about the worst thing I've ever heard. Because,
totally.
You know, it's like, well, oh, no. So now I'm afraid about being afraid, you know, because
yeah.
that's a bad thing. And it really, it just doesn't help. And I think more now so that, you know, we've gotten a good 30, 40 years past, you know, the, I guess, sports beginning to really mm-hmm. peak in our society. And it was very much gladiator-like and things like
right.
that. And
right.
Now it's, no, you got to know what you're getting yourself into and deal with it first.
Right.
And that is the hardest thing as an adult to try and pass on to somebody else if you haven't been there. So how do you do that with the, you know, the coaches that you work with? How do you teach them to not scare people about being scared, if you will?
So I often talk about, rather than lots of people talk about conquering fear or, you know, eradicating fear, I often talk about transforming fear and transforming fear into fuel, because fear, it's just part of a continuum. And it's part of a continuum of just, you know, physiological arousal. And part of that continuum is also excitement. And so it's really being able to recognize that it's like, you know, it's a button that's turned on too high. I often tell many of my clients when they think that there's something wrong with them, and I say, you know, like, weaknesses are merely strengths that are turned up too high. And so we just need to learn how to moderate those strengths so that they are serving you and showing up for you in the best possible way. And so helping the coaches even just get into that framework of, you know, because it's hard. So I, you know, of course, being trained as a dancer, and I taught dance, and, you know, and I think teaching dance and coaching are very similar in that you're so almost socialized to be looking for what's wrong, right? You're always looking to give corrections. You're always looking to give feedback. So your mind, it's almost the dial is set on look for what's wrong. And looking at what's going well and giving praise on what's well, it's really difficult. And so I often work with coaches to be able to, like, set what we call the reticular activating system in our brain, which is basically what sets the, what are you going to be focused on this time, right? It could be something negative or something positive. People notice it usually when they, like, if you need to sell your house or buy a house, all of a sudden you start looking at all the for sale signs and all the for rent signs. And before, you didn't notice them before, you know, but they
right.
were still there. It's just that you're sort of attuned to those things, and it's kind of the same thing, you know, and I kind of help them start being attuned to what's going well. And then to start then recognizing when things get out of alignment, because it's easy, right? Like, the things that are not going well are going to be pretty, like, salient. You don't need to be looking for them. They're going to, like, hit you in the face, you know? But
right.
you can start helping your kids and validating for them all of the ways in which you see them doing well and all of the ways in which they are gifted and all of the ways in which they are showing up really powerfully and they are doing the right thing. Kids just bloom, and they want more of that. And because they want more of that, they will be paying attention to what the coaches are saying. And so in some ways, it's like you will get more bees with honey than with vinegar, you know, but it's been a really old system, especially in coaching, that it's like about, you know, looking at what's wrong and almost like hardcore intimidation and that kind of thing. You know, and so in some ways I teach the coaches some of that. I also teach them for them to start recognizing their own intuition, so that they can honor their athletes And this is a little bit trickier because now we go into something that's very abstract. But so intuition is a higher knowing, but it doesn't mean that doesn't take into consideration the brain, right? In some ways, there's like as many neurons in the heart. I think that there's more neurons in the heart than there are in the brain. And we are now recognizing that through research, which is really, really cool. And that in order to be powerful athletes, powerful speakers, powerful leaders, really, we need to be in alignment with our bodies and our minds. And I think that there's been this really long-standing tradition, especially in sports, of pushing and pushing past the limits, which often teach athletes to get disconnected from their bodies.
Right.
And they're just sort of in their heads because the only way to get through the pain is to disconnect. It makes me a little emotional because in some ways that's exactly what happened to me. You know, like I was hearing, but I wasn't paying attention because there was a thing that I needed to do and I was going to do that.
Well, right there, you, and I wonder if that's, I was going to ask you, you mentioned about making sure that coaches honor their athletes and to define that, because that's kind of where you were, was trying to figure out that decision at that moment for you, is what to honor, to do or not to do. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could define, mm-hmm. because I have an idea what that means, but I really want to hear your interpretation, because I think that's the connecting point here. When people are hearing what you're talking about, I think this is where they really understand it, is what does it mean to honor that student, whatever.
So I think that coaching is a really, it's a pretty awesome profession, and you also have a pretty awesome responsibility, you know, like you're almost like a second parent, you know, you have that much mm-hmm. influence on kids' lives. And that's really what's really cool. And that's also what's kind of scary if you don't recognize how big of a responsibility that is. And so so I think that as coaches, it is our responsibility to get to know our athletes and to get to know like who they are as people and how do they tend to respond, right? So there might be athletes that are like a little, I don't want to say lazy, but they sort of, you know, they're there just because their friends are there. They're not really there for themselves all that much. You know, like you need to push them a little bit more. Right. And mm-hmm. and so you need to be able to learn what pushes that athlete, because a lot of times we think it's like it's hardcore, you know, and sometimes it is. But sometimes it is actually encouragement, you know, which we don't use very much. But there's also athletes, and I see this more and more, especially as athletes get to be kind of, you know, go through the ranks and they become more and more elite. Athletes are doing stuff at a higher level. They're there because they love their sport. They care about their sport a great deal, and they're usually putting a huge amount of pressure on themselves. And so, you know, coaches think like, okay, well, I'm going to tell them like, this is do or die, you know, so that they can really like rise up and do their very best. And they don't realize that when they do that, they're actually knocking their athletes off what I call the zone of optimal functioning. Because their athletes are already there. Like, they're already putting that much pressure on themselves, you know? And so in mm-hmm. some ways, it's about being able to know your athletes and know when do you push and when do you, like, you know, if you see an athlete maybe, like, limping or something like that, you might, you know, call them up and ask them what's going on, you know? And they might be like, oh, I'm fine. And if you see them limping, that sometimes you just need to pull them off, you know? You just need to pull them off the field and be like, why don't you take care of this and why don't you rest it and see if it feels better? You know, even if that athlete's going to be pissed or crying or whatever, you know, because they just want to be there playing or they don't want to disappoint you or whatever. And they may not kind of recognize what's happening. Now, if you have athletes that are able to say like, I'm hurt or I'm hurting, to be able to say like, okay, what do you need to do for you? Like, how can you take care of you? And then, you know, still be here for the team. Because I think that there's this tendency to be like, you're either like here playing full out or you're out. you know, and so athletes feel a great deal of pressure to always be fine and never say that they're hurting or anything like that because they don't want to be out.
Right, because either you're on the fringe and you want to get stay in, or you've got
right.
this mentality that people are going to be disappointed and so forth. And that's what, you know, your teammates are there for.
Right.
Let me take a second to pause here and let our listeners know
sure.
that if you'd like to speak with Elena, you can call in at 646-716-7979. That's 646-716-7979. And Elena, you've got a program you call it In Flow and On Fire. And I definitely would like to make sure we don't sell that short on the show because I think we now understand where you're coming from and why this is, you know, a legitimate program. But tell us about what that is and how you use it to help others.
Sure. So it's a system that I created. And interestingly, you know, a lot of people, when they hear me say that I do high-performance coaching or that I'm a high-performance psychologist, a lot of people kind of have that, like, that pushback, you know, because they equate high performance with sort of that militant, like push, 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 you know, like hardcore, you know, type of mentality, you know. And so it's been really fascinating for me to see that some people have responded that way. And so I realized that for me, it's really not about that. That for me, it's really about being able to get into the flow. You know, and what I mean by in flow is that state of altered consciousness and awareness where we like lose, you know, we lose touch with time. Time slows down or speeds up, where everything just kind of flows easily and effortlessly. What we used to call like peak performances.
Right.
And, you know, in some ways, you know, athletes and athletics have been sort of like the first people that we were studying doing that. But we've realized that getting into the flow can happen in any activity that we do. You know, and in fact, for me, because I'm a writer, I often get into flow when I'm writing, which is really kind of a fascinating experience, you know, that I could just start writing and all of a sudden, like, I start at night and then all of a sudden I start seeing the sun come out and I'm like, oh my God, I didn't go to bed, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I had, you know, lost time, you know, because I've just been, like, so excited doing whatever it is that I'm doing. And so that it's really about learning how to get into your own flow, whether, you know, whether you're an athlete, whether you're a coach, whether you're a writer, a speaker, like it actually doesn't matter because we get to experience this in our everyday lives if we are able to understand the elements of how do we get into it. The second part of that on fire is it just talks about, you know, so much of high performance has been focused on motivation. And I often say that we that the only thing that we need motivation for is to clean toilets. You know, motivation
right.
is the thing that we need to do stuff that we don't like to do. You know, like that's when we need motivation, right? But that in reality, motivation is not really what we need. That what we need is really inspiration. Like we need to be able to inspire ourselves and inspire others to ignite that flame inside of us to that we like get to be on fire, right? Like that we get to be like so excited and so inspired and so on fire about doing something that then we have that perseverance, that dogged determination, that willingness to do anything and everything to accomplish a particular task. And so for me, this idea of In Flow and On Fire is really about marrying these two concepts and these two energies and ways of being that really allows us to really unlock and or unleash our potential and get to show up as, you know, the best people that we can be.
Yeah, and I like when you talk about, you know, the on fire part, which is the motivation versus inspiration. And, yeah, there's a lot of things that motivate me, but, you know, that's usually because they're right in my face. It's when those things are not there. in front of you, that person,
right,
or whatever it may be. That's the difference. And, you know, we all, you know, everyone needs a push, because that's what coaches and teachers and mentors
mm-hmm.
are for.
Mm-hmm.
But if, like I say, if all they're doing is, you know, if they have to be there for the motivation, then they're not inspiring along the way. And that's what we're trying to get. We don't want a dependency in that relationship.
Correct.
And that, I think, is very hard for a lot of coaches, whatever their role may be, to realize that you don't make, you know, we say, let's make better people. We're
right.
kind of, I mean, we're enabling them, you know, is what we're
yeah.
doing. Sometimes by, if for no other reason, just don't get in the way. There are some people you look and say, well, you know what I ought to do is just keep smiling and
get out of the way.
Because, yeah, exactly. And then there are others where it's like, okay, I need to help them see around, you know, something
yeah.
where you, I mean, you do insert yourself, but you're not, if you have to make someone into something, there's probably going to be an unhappy ending for that person later on when they realize they've been letting somebody else pull the strings.
I couldn't agree more. I actually have this mantra, especially, you know, I still use it, but especially when I was doing so much of my counseling and psychology practice, I had this mantra that I used to say every day that that was something like, I can't make anybody do anything. You know,
right.
and I would repeat it to myself, I can't make anybody do anything, because when I was able to really inhabit that space, I was able to come very clean to whatever interaction, knowing that I am simply a catalyst. You know, I can support, I can inspire, I can encourage, I can, you know, turn on that flame. But ultimately, it is the person's, you know, responsibility to do whatever it is that they're going to do or not do it. And that it's not, you know, if they're successful, it's not because of me. If they're failing, it's not because of me, you know. And I think that it's just being able to take our ego out of the way and just knowing that we are just simply, you know, guides and catalysts to what they are already there to become.
Yeah, so eloquently put, but boy, is that hard to do. And especially just, you know, when you think about it, especially, you know, so many people in the coaching, teaching, you know, business, even if they're not getting paid, especially when they're doing it for free, are
yeah.
doing it because they've got kids. And that makes it even harder for them. Yet those are the people that have the greatest potential to help out. I mean, it is the parent that's in it for kids like theirs, but it's really difficult to turn off the parent switch without thinking you're abandoning them. And I when I ask you, maybe because you have that, you know, psychologist, you know, as a practice in that, have, you know, you mentioned, you know, a couple of things there, but what else can you, I guess, offer to people besides
yeah.
you can't make
yeah.
someone do anything
well.
Because, you know, you've walked it, you've talked it, and, you know, you've lived it. What do you do for someone like me that says, yeah, I get that, but I can't do it. I need a little bit more.
Well, so here's, I mean, and, you know, I didn't necessarily talk about the steps of my blueprint or anything like that, but there is this concept that I teach. It's very easy to teach and understand and very, very hard to practice,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the reason why I often say that if you are going to be a coach or a teacher, it's the reason why you need to be, why you need to have hired a coach or a mentor or join a mastermind, because we need to keep growing. We need to continually be getting the support to grow so that we can show up in the way that we need to show up for all of the people that are relying on us. And it's a fascinating thing because so athletes are the only people that I know of that really, really get the concept that as you grow and go through levels, like as you improve, that you need to get more coaches and not less, right? Like as athletes go through level, they hire more and more coaches, more and more specialized coaches. You know, Olympic athletes have like gajillions of coaches that are supporting them and helping them get there. But then everybody, somehow we think that if we need to hire a coach or we need to get support or need to have a mastermind, like that there's something wrong with us. So I think it's really fascinating to me to see that, because I think that this is like part of the fabric of how we've been indoctrinated and that it's like not okay to get support. So the concept that I'm alluding to this because I think that it's that we need to be in constant state of grow to keep to be able to actually put into practice these concepts, right? So there's this concept that I talk about that it's called passionate detachment, which means really being fully invested and super passionate and 100% into something, and then completely detaching from the outcome, detaching from the expectation of a particular outcome, which is incredibly, incredibly hard. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Like, right, how
right.
do I detach from, you know, not wanting my kid to win? How do I detach from, like, not wanting my kid to, like, not make a mistake or, you know, all of these things? And, you know, I think that the biggest thing is kind of, for me, it's always remembering kind of the bigger purpose. And it's like, we don't own our kids. You know, we have chosen to become guides and mentors to these beautiful souls that are coming in, and they get to make their own decisions and they get to create their own life. And we are there to support, to teach, to create as much structure and as much guidance for them to make the best decisions. And they also need to experience failing, and they need to experience pain, and they need to experience, like, you know, hardship, because in some ways that is the only way that they get to learn their own lessons. That's the only way that they get to accrue wisdom. You know, we get knowledge through learning stuff. We accrue wisdom through experience, and we can't take that away from anybody.
Yeah, and just to recap a few things there, I mean, I definitely agree with you that as we get older, other than, you know, we will have our professional development hours, if you will, but that's in a room. It's definitely not intimate. There's not a lot of connection
right.
that goes on there. And that's about, I think that's the excuse for, of course we're growing, you know, we go to conferences
right.
and things like that. And sure, I talk to people, you know, in the hallway. What'd you think about, you know, breakfast? That's kind of,
right.
you know, and on occasion you might actually get into something. But I definitely have found that I wouldn't have thought of that. But as I've started doing more of this, when I've started doing some training for various groups, and it's engaging with a group of parent coaches or something like that, it's very, very different. And they're doing just as much for me. And it is, you know, it's very interactive, as you say, and there it is a coaching experience, but then it goes away. And that's so even that, when it happens, it just unfortunately, you know, I think a lot of people get a lot out of it, but they're not. I've even said, hey, you know, you can email me anytime, you know, give me a day or two to get back to you. And only in a couple cases has anybody, you know, reached back to me. And, oh, this is over 15 years. Now, even on the professional side, doing some workshops amongst engineers. And I had actually, you know, one town actually that took me up on it. And I said, well, that's great. And we talked,
good.
You know, I said, yeah, I'm here to, I got 5 minutes for you. If I'm sure I'll learn something from whatever your problem is. And, I didn't realize that's what I've been doing that, but I never realized, like you said, how, it's just not part of anybody's lifestyle except for, you know, on the adult side, except for athletes, that yes, you need more coaches. And the rest of us, no, we got to go it alone. It's a pyramid, and you've got to be the one that knows the most.
Yeah, and it's pretty sad, because I think that it actually curtails our potential, you know. And I mean, and I see it so much with the coaches and the entrepreneurs I work with. You know, the ones that actually are willing to invest into joining my mastermind, and they actually, you know, like, come in, and then they are open and authentic, and then they get the support, and they support others, and, like, they achieve so much more, much quicker than people that just want to do individual work, way much more than, I mean, that people are like, oh, let me just figure it out on my own, you know, like, people that want to figure it out on their own, they're still, like, circling the drain, you know. And so it's really quite fascinating to see, and sad at the same time, you know, because it's like this is part of the mentality that we have fostered. You know, it's something that we've been marinated in, and so to be able to start breaking through that for all of us, you know, like people often ask me, because I'm always like doing trainings and in masterminds and doing all this stuff, and they're like, you went to school for 17 years, you have 4 degrees, what else? Like, I'm like, well, I really believe in practicing what I preach. And if I am telling all my clients that they need to keep on growing, that they need to keep getting, you know, coaches or doing masterminds, then I need to be doing that too. Like, I'm not better than, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like we all still have so much more room to grow.
Well, and with that, because I've only been exposed recently to what a mastermind is, and it's definitely different. Please explain that to people, what that is, you know, compared to a lecture or a workshop.
Oh, wow. Yeah, absolutely. Masterminds are powerful because so lectures or workshops are very much driven. They're like student teacher kind of thing, you know, so like so it would be kind of like me. I'm talking right now and then everybody else is just like listening and taking notes. And masterminds are, you know, while there's, you know, I certainly facilitate them. It is not centered on me or just me teaching, but rather it's really a collaborative. So it's really about the idea that, you know, more heads think better than just one. And so, you know, one person might bring, you know, they might say, here's an issue that I'm having, you know, with one of my clients, or here's an issue that I'm having with one of my students or in my business. And I'm not really sure what I need to do, or how do I get out of this, or how do I move forward, or whatever. And then every single member of the mastermind then take turns to give them feedback or suggestions or resources, or connect them to somebody else that might be able to help them and support them. So it's very much about everybody's expertise and everybody's experience and wisdom is valued. Celebrated. Everybody contributes to the benefit of everybody else, basically. And so it's highly interactive.
Yeah, so no wallflowers in these, I take it.
No, not at all. No, not at all. And they're usually small groups. So my masterminds are never bigger than 10. So people need to apply for them. I vet them pretty carefully because while everybody can benefit from being in a mastermind, not everybody can benefit from the person, you know, and so they need to be people that are not only willing and open and ready to get support, but also people that have something of value to offer, you know, that people that are willing to contribute to other people's growth, and that they are all committed and invested in growing together. So it's really, really powerful when I do a good job at selecting people.
Well, and that's what is very different about it, that we all, you know, should be, I mean, if you're not sure about going to a mastermind, you should be signing up for workshops where there is some,
yeah,
you know, participation, you know, a little interaction with the speaker. And I think then when you find that that's not enough, you know, or that you actually like participating, then, right, you're ready for a mastermind, because there is a risk. I mean, no one should be afraid to go to one, but it really...
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, they should be
right,
excited about it. It's like they're usually...
Exactly, yeah. Right, they are, but you need to know what you're getting yourself into. Like, if you are just...
Right.
If you don't have, for whatever reason, don't have the energy, don't go. And, you know... When you're there, like I say, it's not so much about it, it's not a debate. You know, it's not what we do around
right.
the water cooler.
No, not a debate.
Yeah, you actually, yeah, I mean, but it is your chance to, without being, if you will, the instructor, you, there will be your role at some point within a mastermind. That, oh,
mm-hmm.
someone's learning from you. And I think that's maybe what some people miss out. I wish someone would just listen to me. Well,
right.
your turn will come in one of those while you're learning, you know, and things like that.
Totally. Well, yeah. And it's kind of like everybody having each other's back, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, so they'll be your turn for people to help you. And then, but, you know, as you know, a lot of times, even from the perspective of sometimes we're struggling, you know, like, and I see this often. it's usually people when they're struggling, they have a harder time showing up and a harder time wanting to say that they're struggling and wanting to say that they need help. And what's really beautiful is to see them, you know, and then somebody else will show up and then somebody else will be like, I'm having a hard time with X, Y, and Z. And then that's something that they happen to actually be able to do really easily and come super easily to them. And then all of a sudden they start sharing and then the other person's like, oh my gosh, that was super helpful. And then all of a sudden, you know, you were struggling and then you just made a difference in somebody else's life. And that feels really good, you know, and you kind of realize like, oh, like maybe I'm not like, you know, maybe I'm not so crappy after all, you know, and then it can give you like the courage to then say, here's the stuff that I'm struggling with, right? And then have others support you. And so it's a really powerful process.
Well, and is that something
in some
now,
ways it's a little bit like being in a team.
Right. And that's what I was just kind of thinking here is, you know, if for coaches to not necessarily, obviously, it's great if they can get to your level of expertise facilitating, but even understanding how it works in general, just in a group discussion, that idea, to me, that seems like a tool. That person, if they can just do it a little bit once in a while with whether it's people in their, you know, their group at work, whether they are coaches, whatever it may be, that's just something that is going to serve them as much as it helps everybody to actually just get other people, you know, I've always said, I like to throw out the dumb ideas because at least we get them, we can all agree on them and get them out of the way, you know, and then suddenly the younger staff start, you know, saying things, and usually it starts with, this is going to sound stupid, but I'm like, oh, here it comes. This is going to be the best one. You know, I learned that. I forgot where I read it. It was probably from someone like yourself that whenever you hear somebody say, I know this is, you're going to think this is dumb, but that's when that person is, you know, they want to be part of a mastermind setting for that, that engagement to get that, like you say, that flow and eventually catch the fire.
So, to come back. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if you could, I guess I wanted to talk about some of your other practices, but I definitely don't want to leave you hanging on this because that flow and the fire and getting through it, that is the question. Like everyone says, get in the zone and hurry up about it, you know, but this really is a much more natural, you know, way of doing it where you own that process.
Right. So, you know, and I'll share some of the practices because I think that, you know, I've shared some things that are theoretical, but I really want to give some of the audience and the listeners some practices because the idea of getting into flow, like I was kind of obsessed with like, well, how do I, like, how can I control that, right? Like, how can I make that happen? And that might be something that some of your coaches are thinking like, well, yeah, great. Tell me exactly what do I need to do to like make it happen. So the first thing is that you cannot make it happen. Flow is not something that you can control. And, you know, some people are going to be going like, oh, like, what the hell? You know, like, because I was kind of disappointed to kind of realize like it's not something that you can control. However, if you can understand it well enough, you can do everything that you can to set up the right conditions for it to happen more often. And the more that it happens, you know, like once it happens and you start noticing what were all the things that you did, and then you start setting up those conditions, the more likely for it to happen again and again. So, And this I'm just going to quote from Csikszentmihalyi, who is really the pioneer and one of the leading researchers that really got the concept of flow into mainstream. And one of the things that he said is that in order for flow to occur, there needs to be a balance between challenge and competence. That if you are putting yourself or an athlete into a situation where the challenge is so much higher than the skill level, you will have wicked anxiety. And so when you are seeing some of your players have like wicked performance anxiety, or even like some of these younger players get panic attacks, then it is very likely that they are being put to perform at a level that they are not quite skilled enough to perform at. You know, it's really, really important. And so in some ways, one of the things that I say is do not expect anyone to perform, to do anything either on stage or on the field that they have not previously done in practice. Right? So the practice level already needs to be really high, and you will expect that their performance on the field or on stage is going to decrease somewhat from whatever their highest performance is on practice. If they have not gotten a skill in practice, don't expect them to get it stage or on the field. It's just not going to happen. And so being able to set up a condition where the challenge is meeting their skill level, you know, they're feeling stretched, but they feel competent and confident, then it's more likely for them to be able to get into flow.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that, 30-some years ago, playing basketball in middle school, there was one day where I had just made some shot that actually worked, you know, something I'd been working on all year. And I remember the coach saying, why can't you do that in the game? And I'd never done it anywhere before. And I said, I don't know. And it really stuck with me. But that was kind of the whole point of practice was, as opposed to that, it would have been a lot nicer to hear, all right, see, now you can do that in the game. And that's fantastic.
And what the difference of those little words makes?
They do.
Right?
They do. And we think it's all, it's just, do I have to get every little word right? Sometimes, like you say, to encourage the flow to occur, you do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I love that you said that because those are some, like, very small words, semantic difference. Flow will never occur with anxiety. So if you're yelling at your athletes or you're yelling at their face, don't expect them to get into flow.
Yeah, I think it just shows how talented they are when they can actually perform, when they've got that much working. I mean, when you think about it, if you're like, well, I couldn't do someone yelling at me. Well, you'd learn, but that just shows how you're finding some other talent that you still weren't doing somebody else could have gotten you to do.
Absolutely. So the second component of flow is, I call it mind like water. Ability to be able to be fully present in the moment and, you know, with this heightened ability to be able to stay focused. And the only way that we do that is, again, by practicing. So a lot of times, you know, especially as I start working with people, you know, I ask them, like, how many days are you practicing, you know, for your sport? And they will say, like, 5 to 7 days. And then I'll say, well, how many days are you meditating? And they'll be like, none. I'm like, okay, well, like all of your mental skills are just like physical skills. So would you expect yourself to run a marathon if you went to the gym once and then that was good enough? They're like, no, of course not. Okay, well, that's exactly what we do with mental skills. Like we think like, oh, we're just going to give them this little thing or just do this thing once, or we'll just have an expert come in and talk to them one time, and then that's going to do it, you know? And it's like, no, that's not going to do it. Like, they need to learn the skills, and they need to be able to practice them every single day and then integrate them into their practice in the field every single day for that to come through at game time.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people aren't sure what meditating is. I've only become familiar with myself recently, but it comes in some disguises, including Michael Phelps. His coach used to tell him, pop in the tape. And what he told him was he'd go to bed at night, and he would, as he was going to bed, he was thinking through every stroke of a race.
Yeah.
And that essentially was him getting his mind ready. And then when it was time to swim, he would just cue him up, you know, no pun intended. He would say, Michael, pop in the tape. And he just, you know, connected with what he knew he had to do, you know, the turns and everything else. And that's a real thing, but nobody would call that meditating. Yet that's essentially you know, what he was doing was, you know, he was apparently every night he did that.
Yes.
You know,
so there's a component of that. There's meditation and then there's visualization, which I think is what he was referring
to. Okay, I got you.
And so that's sort of the other skill. Yeah. But so so one of the things that I'd love to share with some of your listeners is I've actually put together a course that is really meant to help people kind of some of the practices that they need to start incorporating into their life to increase their focus, to increase their productivity, to increase their performance. It's basically like 7 different videos and worksheets and stuff like that for them to actually put that into practice. And I'd love to give that link to your listeners because it's a really, really powerful resource and a really great way to kind of start getting into kind of what might this look like and how might I integrate this into my life. And you know, like there's all these different things that, of course, I haven't gotten a chance to talk about, but they'll get to have access to all of that there.
And
the link to
that,
if that's okay.
Give them your information, but then everyone, we're going to we'll post that on some of the Facebook as well as the Twitter. But I definitely want to make sure you know how to get a hold of Elena, because you can see we've just scratched the surface with what she can do. So, Elena, again, tell them how they can get a hold of you.
Yeah. So how they can access that course is tinyurl.com/quantum-Elena, E-L-E-N-A. So tinyurl.com/quantum-Elena, E-L-E-N-A. And that's how they can get access to that course. And then how they can access me is just through my website at intuitivebusinessmastery.com. And it's all one word, intuitivebusinessmastery.com.
Yeah, and I do really recommend people go to that because I have looked into that. Which was one of the reasons I was excited when Elena offered to be on the show. And in fact, for those of you that may not be is interested in the coaching, she's got through Luminous Stages of Business Development, which again, it's a really cool framework. And in fact, she's got some documents on there that you can, you know, make use of. But I think you're definitely going to like your approach. Elena, I think I definitely like to have you on the show again because
thank you.
You've really cut across between teaching, mentoring, sports, adults, in between. is there any, I guess also, tell me about your show because you also have a show. When does it come on?
Yeah, my show is called Ignite Your Luminescent Life, Intuitive Business Mastery and SaaS. And it comes on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. And I only do it twice a month. And so it's usually kind of on every other week, like the second and the fourth week, I think, of the month. So, thank you.
Right. But as always, though, if the timing doesn't work out for you, you can also go to Coach on Fire Radio. You can look for replays and things like that. And again, there's always a description of what the topics are. But again, this is what's always so nice so far. It's been a pleasant surprise for me on the show here is that this really is, for me, this is, as you put it, sort of my mastermind because, you know, it's one thing for me to tell people what I think, which isn't, it's not like a very exciting 60 minutes, but it's been, I always really enjoy interacting. I mean, that's really what this is.
I
do hope that we can do it again and also that people see again what it's like when you're in the driver's seat facilitating a discussion on your show. And again, Elena, thank you so much. And we will have you on again in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David. It's a total pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And again, everyone, thank you very much for this week listening in. Starting in June, we will be switching from biweekly to weekly shows, and very excited about that. So, again, have a great evening, and thanks for listening.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Fire Radio.